What is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome back to the Elder Scrolls podcast. I'm Scott, here with Michael and Drew, as always. And today, we are discussing the Nords, the people of Skyrim. In rather broad terms, so which one of you wants to start us off?
Well, that's up for debate, isn't it? Are they the people of Skyrim, or are they intruders from Atmora?
Well, they're the people of Skyrim for about 3,000... years plus about 4,500 years, because there's like 4,500 ish of recorded history, I think, and even more, like probably about 500 years more than that. So
what you're saying is it does belong to the Nords.
Well, I feel like if they've been there for like 5,000 years, which is, I don't know, do the math on how many generations of people that is, I feel like there's a reasonable claim there, right?
It's a good few generations. Yeah.
I mean, it all depends whether Kain breathed them onto the throat of the world, or if
Even at this point, it doesn't even really matter, you know what I mean, after that much time. Wouldn't you say?
No, sorry, I derailed this immediately by making you pick a side on the war. But yeah, well, that's the thing, because Children of the Sky is a good text to kind of introduce the Nords, because, you know, they believe they were exhaled on the world by their god Kain, who is the same as Kinnereth. And before you really get to know the Nords in Skyrim, they're a lot more mysterious and almost alien than just kind of northern Scandinavian almost inspired humans. You know, you've got, first of all, them being, the idea of them being exhaled, they take quite literally, in the sense that they believe they are eternal outsiders and invaders wherever they are, you know, anywhere they conquest. They have nothing in common, even with other humans. So it kind of goes against the idea that they were just Nedic settlers, just like, you know, the Bretons and the North, Bretons and the Imperials.
And I do like that in its earlier sort of incarnations of the lore, that them being breathed onto the world, like breath inherently being such like a powerful thing in their culture and such an important thing, because the breath becomes, you know, the Thorm, and like, you know, shouting all of these words. It's kind of interesting that, like, you know, the, you can imagine, like, as in organs, like the tongue and lungs and stuff become far more relevant in their culture. And it's just an interesting sort of piece.
Well, Skyrim is like, you know, it makes total sense that Skyrim, the way we see it, isn't just a frozen wasteland, because that's not the best for exploration and for an RPG. But, you know, a description of them, I think it's also from Children of the Sky, is saying the further north you go into Skyrim, the more powerful and elemental the people become, and the less they require dwellings and shelters. Wind is fundamental to Skyrim and the Nords. Those that live in the far wastes always carry a wind with them. So, yeah, the idea that breath and wind is essential to them, it's almost like they have some kind of magical connection to it.
And it's cool how it ties in with, obviously, the Thorm and the voice, and being breathed onto the world. But even, like, you look at other aspects of the voice, I know this is a really niche reference, but bards, like, you know, using their voice to sing, and bards are extremely prominent in Nord culture. Like, it seems like anything to do with breath, voice, air,
just wins. It's easy to, after playing Skyrim, it's kind of easy to perceive the Thum as just being, like casting spells. It's just a tool to use. But before that, or in the lore at least, it's very much tied into their culture, and it drastically changes a lot about them. You know, like the idea that they wouldn't develop siege engines, because they can just stand in a V and just scream at the door and blow the gates down.
Because that's such a cool, what I've always liked about those early interpretations too, is it's using like their like magic type of magic system or whatever to basically circumvent problems with like the barbarian archetype. So, you know, they're resistant to cold, so they can wear like their cool, you know, shirtless barbarian sort of outfits. They don't need all of this big engineering. They really can just be berserkers with axes, because if they do ever, you know, obviously the problem with that is, oh, well, you can't beat advanced technology. You need siege engines and stuff to beat castles and be big conquerors, but they can, because they can just blow down the walls. And it's, so I love those, you know, examples in, you know, any world building, I guess, when you use the magic to sort of just make something work like that. Like, so basically making barbarians practical. Obviously they sort of, you know, shifted it around a little bit, you know.
Yeah, they changed it a lot. Although it does fit in with that parabolic Kalpa theory, doesn't it? Of how things are like more magical, and then you come to the present and they're like more mundane.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder what you guys think. My hot take is, like, I actually like the Dragon Colton dragon. The dragon lore is quite interesting, like, you know, on its own and as it is. But I would like, if I was like to do it all again, I would remove the whole dragon connection voice and just leave it as like Alduin was a Ragnarok kind of thing and an enemy, rather than this whole dragon cult and the dragons connected to the Thorm and the voice and everything like that. Instead, keep it separate and, like, you know, flesh out the lore of the Nords as they were with all of the...
Almost, you know, it's not really possible, but you could almost have it be retconned in a sense that dragon was just potentially some kind of moniker used for ancient Nords, you know. So the Dragon War could have just been a civil war between two Nordic factions or something like that. I mean, the idea that, I mean, obviously you can't do that now, but that idea would have really added to Nordic lore.
Well, that's the thing. Like, you're taking Skyrim...
me back to the episode where it's the companions... our dragons.
Oh,
yeah.
Coming from Mora, flying together.
We've been in the iceberg too much.
Because Skyrim basically, like, the game brought in pretty much all the dragon stuff, basically. Like, before that, I'm pretty sure it was just, you know, there was Alduin as, like, this Ragnarok figure, and dragons had been in the past. But all of the dragon cult in general wasn't even a thing.
But you could have done that without messing with the voice. Like, you could actually keep the cool parts to do with Dragon Wars and the cults and stuff that are cool, but then just not give them the Thorm and say it's dragon language.
You it's just an opportunity cost thing. I think they could have gone...
You could have kept them separate, yeah.
But they could have, like,
Just
I mean,
not
I'm,
done it at all.
I mean, like, look, the dragon... Even the dragon stuff, like fighting dragons and stuff in Skyrim is not... Like, gimmicky is the wrong word, but it's kind of like a one-hit thing. Like, you've... First playthrough, it's like, whoa, cool, dragons, everything, you do all that, and then after you're like, oh, here's another dragon, this is annoying, it's just another enemy type. You
it
know
could have
I mean?
Been cool if there were way less dragons and just more named ones, and that each one was more quality. Like, I'm not saying the ones, because they did named ones and then didn't tell you anything about them.
Yeah. Although, does it feel more gimmicky because we're 10 years on from...
It does, but I think Scott's point still stands that they don't need it, because it did feel gimmicky. Like, even after a long playthrough, you go back and play Skyrim again and it's like, oh, do I even want to do the main story straight away, because then I'm gonna have dragons just appearing when I fast travel somewhere and causing me problems and things.
But
like
all that aside, the Nords are the way they are now, and it still is, like, you know, all of the lining up for the siege engine stuff, that's all in the ancient history as well. It's just now that the Thorm is attached to dragons, and, you know, they've worked in things like, you know, saying that, you know, they can say that people sort of work with the lore and go like, oh, Parthenax taught the Nords at the behest of Kine and so on. So that sort of links it all together. But so I think for the current lore, I think it makes more sense that they are from Atmora. It's just more congruent with all of the other lore. However, if you go watch the video we made a while ago called Secrets of Atmora, that talks about a theory and explaining how, like, if there is a sundering of Aldmeris and so on, they could have both can actually be right. They could have been breathed onto the world by Kine, and then actually, you know, when the sundering of the continents happened, they were, like, left up on that side of Atmora and, you know, came back later. And that's why it's the return, you know, of his girl. Oh, he actually returned another time, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Makes sense. I guess a lot actually changed if you think about it. I mean, you go and look at ancient Nord religion versus just standard Nordic pantheon versus what it turned into in Skyrim, which is basically just following the divines.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the kind of a bit of the problem with Skyrim's lore. I think it's one of the worst things it did was it gets rid of the, you know, the Nordic pantheon, which is called ancient Nordic pantheon. But I'm pretty sure it seems implied that the Nordic pantheon, as, you know, Kine, Shaw, etc., we're all worshipped up until, like, you know, in the Third Era. Like, it's this imperialization's only happened in, like, the last 200 years. Because I remember there's NPCs and stuff that would reference them by their Nordic names and, you know...
They have a lot of expressions with the old gods, but you don't actually find anyone, I think, except at Froki's Shack, where Froki is a follower of Kine, specifically. Mm. You don't really find Nords worshipping the old gods. I mean, and before the Nordic pantheon even, they have all the animal gods that they worship, and then there are design documents that, like, were just design documents for Skyrim that like actually matched the animals up with the gods. So you have like, I think Shore is like some of the fox.
He's a fox. Yes. Some of those have been confirmed in
Elder Scrolls Online.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool that they actually brought that stuff into the online game.
Yeah. It's the same situation as the Khajiit, how like they've created like, you know, there's all this like, oh, there's cool ancient religion, but now it's like post just this Riddlethar stuff and all that kind of is the modern contemporary sort of Khajiit so on. Mm-hmm. Same as like how contemporary Nords are way less cool than their ancient counterparts. And it's kind of just...
Yeah, because that's the thing. When obviously a lot of time has passed since then, but when the Divines first came into being, when Alicia kind of forged them basically from... mixing elements of the Nordic pantheon with the Elven pantheon, the Nords weren't really that interested in any of the Elven elements, and really only Nords who were living in, you know, who were living closely to the Empire would really have cared about even following the Divines. There's no reason why they couldn't just keep their own totems, and just, you know, involving the Nordic gods in the Divines was only really to benefit the humans who lived in Cyrodiil, who didn't really like their Elven oppressors.
Yeah, and the Nords too. And this, I guess, you know what we should do? We should kind of like actually make a big call, but like humanity has a lot to thank the Nords for, because without the Nords, there would be no Elysian Rebellion. Like the Elysians relied hugely on the Nords, and that's why the whole Eight Divines thing was like, you know, a bit of a compromise. Like they can't just have all of these Elven elements because they've got to keep their Nord friends happy and so on. That in the Nordic Empire at this time was, you know, expanding, and Skyrim, it was down into Cyrodiil, and they helped, you know, liberate the needy population of Cyrodiil. And, you know, so... For those reasons, like, and you know, Nords were the, yeah, you know, Isgrimor's coming and everything, and the growth of the Nordic Empire was the only reason that Elven dominance ever really ceased.
You know what I mean? For sure.
So it's like without it, like, you know, you just gotta, you don't know what's exactly what would have happened. Maybe that's an interesting what if video. What if Isgrimor never came?
Yeah, I guess the Merethic era would just keep going. Because, I mean, really, that's like era of the elves. Merethic era. Hmm.
Well, just a bit, yeah.
Keep it going.
Because obviously the Yakudans and the Redcards had some influence. Like there were the Dorakhinids who were out in the west. And they did fairly well. They weren't immediately subjugated by elves. But then if you go east, I think this is fairly new lore, but there are hints at Needs having lived in Morrowind before the Nords conquered a bunch of it, except I don't think they fared quite as well.
And there was Need fights with Khymer, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
In there as well. But like overall, like Needs, most places, except maybe the Dorakhi Needs, were pretty much under the thumb of some kind of elf, or they were just, you know, reclusive, primitive sort of tribes or scattered around. But, you know, there was no superpowers of...
They wouldn't stand a chance, basically, against all of the elvish armies and, like, the Dwemer.
Generally believed that the Needs who became the Bretons were the best off of pretty much all the Needs. And they were, you know... pretty well subjugated by the elves and were pretty much just used as, you know, breeding slaves for the most part. So yeah, without the Nords turning the tables, the era of elves, the Merethic era, would probably never have ended.
But perhaps this is all part of the, like, you look at the Imperials with their luck power, right? That's what it is. The Nords came to help them. It's their innate luck, and that's why they always win. They got the Empire and they got big and strong. It's just luck. They're just roll the dice. Well,
it's interesting too, like even the whole reason for the Khymer and Dwemer teaming up is only to fight off the Nordic oppression that, like, you know, that had taken over their taken over Rezdane. So it's like if the Nords were never there for that to happen, like I doubt the Dwemer or Khymer would have ever got along, because they're so, like, you know, absolutely opposed on either ends of their philosophy.
Goes to show how powerful the Nords were in that time, that you know, the Dwemer and the Khymer, who were considered pretty strong, needed to team up despite all their problems just to stop the poxy humans coming over the mountains.
Yeah, I think people definitely overstate the power of the Dwemer. Like the Dwemer and the Khymer together got stomped over all over by the Nords. like some barbarians come up, just start shouting and stuff and throwing axes and they, you know, take over your whole land.
I guess that's the thing though. The Nords, I think it's not so much that the Dwemer are overestimated. I think Nords are just underestimated.
Yeah.
Because they are viewed as just barbarians throwing
axes. No, I definitely think it's a Dwemer overstated thing.
I think with the Dwemer...
Yeah, just because people like go, like they make out that the Dwemer are like... You know, it can just fix everything and they're like time traveling everything and just doing like basically kind of the way they talk about them is like, you know, indestructible. Like if they didn't disappear, they'd be like,
yeah,
you know,
I mean,
running the world.
There's an important thing to say about the Dwemer in that defensively, I feel like they would still be fairly untouchable because, you know, if the Nords had been left to go crazy in Morrowind, they would have conquered the surface perhaps, but I doubt they would have had much luck dealing with the Dwemer if they wanted to get rid of them completely. You know, yeah. Defensively, I imagine the Dwemer would be pretty hard to stop.
Because the one thing to remember for the Dwemer and so on is, like, people like these... All the tonal architecture was done with all of, like, you know, big machines and engineering and all this kind of stuff. It's not just, like, magical powers click. Because if that were the case, then they could just do everything and just take over everywhere and would have no problems.
Yeah, it's but that does tend to be one of those like riding things where it's like really the High Elves should be really good with sword because they've lived to 500. But then there's just stories of like different armies like, oh, the Imperial army here just beat this group of, you know,
yeah, but armies aren't more so much about martial like necessarily
I suppose,
individual. There's way... Like, I mean, there's so many variables.
You could find stories even though of individuals where that's the case. I mean, it's kind of like Fallout where it's like, why doesn't the Institute just teleport everywhere and win? It's like, because then that's a silly story.
Yeah, yeah. Poor Ryan. But I think, look, it's just that it's in the lore that the Dwemer gets stomped all over.
Yeah, yeah.
And that they have to. So I'm sort of like, they were very clearly powerful. It's just that you've got to like...
That's why I think the rein Nords, it in. Yeah, I agree generally. People do overhype the Nords, but... overhype the Dwemer.
Hmm.
But underhyping the Nords happens all the time too. Because it's easy to just think they're just like humans, but big and strong, and they like mead, and they're good in the cold. Like,
it is
a shame they've lost the voice.
Hmm.
Before we
can get onto Jürgen Winkler in a second, but a good way to demonstrate exactly what you say, Mike, was to show that map of how much territory the Nords had at that specific point in the early First Era. And you know, it's they're not just isolated to their frozen wastes in Skyrim. They had a fair amount of land before things started to turn around.
Plenty of land to the east and west, and I mean they got all of Morrowind at one point. And the reason they didn't really go into Cyrodiil, at least northern Cyrodiil at that time, was it just wasn't worth it. They were like, Drell Mountains are annoying and I don't know if I really want to take the area around, you know, Bruma/Bitlower.
But then they got their and allied with the Elysians and so on.
Yeah.
And sort of, that's why I guess why they liberated the Elysians, helped liberate them, not conquer them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But yeah, I definitely think, but still Nords are also, I guess, underrated in times. Like especially I can talk all the time about it, but in the 36 lessons of Vivek, some of the like descriptions of the what they call the demon chieftains in there are really, really cool and mythological. And it makes the Thum sound so much more otherworldly and dangerous. Like they're not just running around going Fusro Dar. It's like there's Hoaga who's like eating mouthfuls of mud and then churning it into like these like thrall kind of armies and so on. Or there's like, you know, talking about them, how they're just uplifting height and, you know, blowing entire villages into the sea and stuff. And like, it just sounds really otherworldly and epic rather than, you know.
It sounds like it's much more on the level of some of the things you would hear about sword singing, like the Pancrato sword sunk a continent. Like it's that level of like... Superpowers, basically.
Don't worry, we'll get there when Elder Scrolls 6 comes out and Hammerfell and it's all sword singers and it's just like...
Fire sword.
Press LB to get your fire sword ability.
Or make it rain thunder swords from the sky.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope not. Or spin really fast in a circle and create a cyclone of swords.
Yeah.
To send people flying through the air. I hope not, but you never know.
But let's bring it back to the Nords. Like, I feel like we'd get lost a little bit on like talking about theories around, you know, Atmorans or not and all of that kind of stuff. But what we can establish is obviously the Dragon War and the dragons did happen. Like that was all a fundamental part of their early culture, even on Skyrim. And then eventually we can kind of glaze over that because, you know, we've talked. Everyone knows about the Dragon.
I guess we should say, like, to the listeners that there'll be lots of podcasts coming, so we'll have time to discuss some of the things that we talk about today in more detail. But to try and cover everything with the Nords, you're going to have 5-hour podcast.
Yeah.
Like, if you were to do it all in its totality.
Yeah. Yeah. So we can walk it forward a little bit, and it's hard to, like, later descendants of Isgrimor, they're at the first, like, dynasty of kings are all descended from Isgrimor up to King Borgus, which we'll get to. But I think it's King Harald, I think it is, who wipes out the last of the dragon cult and so on. And I think that's, I might actually have to pull up the timeline. But it's pretty early, Yeah, the attack falls, so 140, and that's even before, like, the Elysian. So the dragon cult is basically eliminated, or very fringe, before even the Elysian slave rebellion. So in terms of, like, your, like, understanding the timeline, dragon cult stuff is, like, Morethic era and early first era, like first 100 years, if not before, you know. So it's kind of like, at this time they're very much, I guess, the ancient Nordic pantheon is what you could expect as they go on. And obviously they go, time goes on a bit, they help the Elysian rebellion, and I'm pretty sure this happens underneath, yeah, the Skyrim conquest. So Vraga the Gifted, he is the Nord who basically, you know, he's High King, he's one of the descendants of Isgrimor. He basically conquers all of Rezdane and High Rock and northern parts of Cyrodiil and everything. He spreads his domain massively. So he's one of the, hence why it's called the Gifted. And then he helps the Elysian Rebellion get started. Well, not get started, but be successful. And yeah, so then we end up with, you know, what they call the Nordic Empire, but it is kind of still like a kingdom. Like, they didn't have an emperor. They just had their, like, king. But yeah, so that was quite big. But then we keep going a little bit more further in time, and we get to the Elysian Order and the rise of the Elysian Order in the Elysian Empire, which is that zealous, crazy cult. We've talked about them before, so you understand it. But they basically take over the empire. They start enforcing a lot of these Elysian doctrines. They're really strict, very anti-elven. But this actually proves to be idea, but a well-liked idea amongst a lot of Nords, with all the anti-elven sentiment, and particularly King Borgus, the 13th in the line of Isgrimor, decides that he wants to adopt the Elysian faith, and he brings, so obviously he introduces the Elysian faith to Skyrim. Then there's events that move forward. There's some wars with the Elysians in High Rock and so on, and you have a few kings in between. And then we get to Wulfarth, which we talked about, Wulfarth, and he's what brings, he brings back the ancient Nordic pantheon. And then we sort of end up with a Skyrim that has been reduced with the War of Succession in between the end of the reign of King Borgus, who died in the Wild Hunt. I should have said that before, but yeah.
He's going to say, yeah, that'd be important to mention when he sided with the Elysians.
So, sorry, let's just walk it back a little bit. But so he was siding with the Elysians, and he went down to Cyrodiil, and he's like, yeah, let's take over Valenwood with them. But preemptively, it seems that the Bosmer used the Wild Hunt to eliminate King Borgus, and this left a power vacuum because they couldn't properly elect a Jarl. So then there was the Skyrim War of Succession. And because of this civil war that was happening, that is what allowed allowed the First Council, the Chimera, and the Dwemer to team up and actually push them out, because they were dealing with strife already. The Nords were. So then, basically, you get the crumbling of the Nordic Empire throughout the Skyrim War of Succession, and then you're left with roughly more or less what Skyrim is today, and that's kind of how it remains for, you know, more pretty much the rest of time until now. Like, they never really get that big empire back. Maybe it was just in Isgrimor's blood, you know, like, it was only those kings could do it.
Maybe, yeah. But I mean, they also did stop using the voice, so.
Yeah, well, I think.
That's like, I feel like that's like, you're a Jedi and you, like, stop using the force. And you're like, we're just going to use lightsabers. Like, that's still cool, but yeah, no force stuff. Like, you gimp yourself so hard.
Yeah, because the idea is that, you weren't supposed to be, you didn't want to go the way that Alduin went, where it was very much you use your power for your own benefit versus dealing with threats to your people and your life or whatever else. So when it came, so using the voice for conquest was kind of frowned upon by Kine, you know, at least according to Jürgen Windcaller when he started his movement. So yeah, that definitely meant that their history was going to become a lot less, you know, eventful in terms of expansion.
Yeah, I hope I'm not wrong, I'm pretty sure Jürgen Windcaller, unless I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure he is, sorry, it is in the Pocket Guide of the first edition. My bad.
But what were you going to say? A Skyrim edition?
Yeah, a Skyrim edition. But it's interesting that he doesn't really have like any specific date of when he was around.
Well, was it specifically in response to one of the battles in Morrowind? Or the loss at Red... Was it the loss at Red Mountain that made him think, why are we failing? Why do tongues fail?
Okay, so it's when... It would have been like proper round 700 then, like the actual Battle of Red Mountain when the Nords supposedly... You know, you have like Dagoth and... Well, depending on the Wulfthal stories, they say like, you know, Dagoth came and convinced them to come and try and take back Shaw's heart.
Yeah, because I think it's on one of the tablets that says like, you know, he went to meditate for 7 years to figure out why powerful tongues fail or something like that. Which, yeah, I will
and
have
what,
the quote
his,
in a second.
What's his conclusion that we just...
yes,
yeah, shouldn't conclusion, use the voice unless it's to...
I knew it. Okay, I knew
it. Self-defense. The gods or self-defense.
Essentially.
One addition, though. It's in the first Pocket Guide to the Empire edition. It says, basically, you know, Jürgen Windcaller was a thing, but then it says, in gratitude, the Emperor, Type Septim, has recently endowed a new Imperial College of the Voice in Markarth, dedicated to returning the way of the voice to the ancient and honorable art of war. So it may be the mighty deeds of Nord heroes of old will soon be equaled or surpassed on the battlefields of the present day. But that's basically, you know, implying, like, you know, this is written sort of third era. This is implying that... that there is this sort of Imperial College, like in the times of Oblivion or something, there would be this Imperial College of the Voice, and it's actually a taught skill, not just the Greybeards going, no, no, no. I think it's actually the Greybeards. Oh, maybe it's not. I don't know. Maybe the Greybeards are just powerful sort of things. But what I'm saying is it sort of seems like the Voice could have been around in the Third Era and so on at that time. But I feel like it's kind of retconned.
Well, it weighs the idea that the Greybeards, obviously the followers of Jürgen Windcaller, wanted to keep it under wraps or keep it quiet. And then it's actually kind of funny that if what you're getting at is Tiber Septim has kind of given the green light for Nords to use the voice in an offensive way again, that almost sounds like the influence of Wulfthal, you know,
yeah,
through him.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And, but like, I mean, I wouldn't mind it. Like, I would think it's a little bit... cooler, because remember, also pre Skyrim, the actual game, there was no lore about Dragonborn being like sucking up dragon souls and using the voice super well and so on. It was always this sort of like meditative, like learn it, like this power within kind of thing. So it would have been a whole different skill set. That could have been cool, but
yeah.
Anyway,
so it's based on your midichlorian count.
Yeah,
is how good you are with the voice.
Anyway, snap back to reality. Where are we? So where did we leave off? So yeah, so the Nords are driven out of Morrowind. They're back their tiny little empire, and then they have, you know, they sort of join various empires at different times. I know they come under Reman. They then later come under Tiber Septim. There's not a lot. I guess one thing we should actually bring up culturally, maybe perhaps. The various times that Eastern Skyrim is generally more conservative and, you know, stay true to the old ways and so on, and you got a lot of Western Skyrim that, you know, fluctuates and so on. And I think a lot of this, to be honest, is just geography. You've got Solitude, which is a massive port for the
Empire.
For the north. They're right next to High Rock. They're also, like, you know, places like Falkreath and Whiterun, they're all you know, important trading posts and like connected sort of by land and trade routes to Kolovia. So you can imagine a lot more of a sort of cosmopolitan influence. Whereas if you look at places like Winterhold, Windhelm, Dawnstar, a lot more secluded, a lot more harsh land.
And obviously somewhere like Falkreath has the connection to Kublai Khan and Hjalti Earlybeard, who essentially founded the Third Empire. So it's going to be an important part. It's where they started when they went on before the Tiber Wars began, etc. So
the other thing about the East too is that the East is basically the bulwark against the Dunmer, and have been, and so they've been fighting. So there's this constant tension and conflict there, which can keep them, you know, very traditional, very screw the elves kind of attitude, as well. But that's sort of like we see that kind of dynamic reflected all the way up until now when we have the Stormcloaks and the Imperial backed Jarls. Mm. But yeah, what would we like to talk about next? Where do we want to move this conversation? Because there's a lot of places.
Yeah, there's so much stuff. I'm just thinking, like, obviously Nordic culture is really cool to talk about. In general, Nordic culture, but also some of the ancient history, like with Sarthal and stuff, but I feel like we've covered that a lot before too. Like, if you want a good wrap up of the events of Sarthal and Isgrimor, go watch the Let's Explore One of Skyrim's Unsolved Mysteries video where I look at the Temple of Scrib, but at the start I basically do like a neat summary of the whole thing.
And the basic takeaway of that is this is kind of the catalyst for Nordic disdain for elves, because, you know, for a little while they got along, but then the Night of Tears happened, where a bunch of Needs got slaughtered, all but Isgrimor and his sons. They flee, or they head back to Atmora, come back with their companions, and then the Snow Elves regret what they did, because they all get wiped out. So, you know, that kind of sets the tone for the Nords for centuries after that.
Yeah. Well, we could talk about, like, so in terms of just general culture, we can start talking about just, like, obviously their aesthetic is very, like, Viking, you know, Scandinavian Viking kind of things, or, you know, little bits of, what do they call, like, the kingdoms of Rus, R-U-S, you know what I'm talking about, Russia, basically, ancient Russia, when you had that. But those kinds of parts of it have sort of been removed over time, and they're just more straightforward Scandinavian kind of Vikings. But even older lore, so I had a little bit of, like, you know, kind of like Celtic elements and so on in there as well.
And obviously, but I was going to say that they praise being very tough and strong. Like, warrior culture is definitely not an understatement. Like, there's the stories of young men going out into the snow and the high peaks of mountains for weeks to hunt ice wraiths as a way to claim, like, their full status as a citizen. Like, all these old legends and stories are really cool. It's cool that they made you do that to join the Stormcloaks. It's kind of like preserving that history, like, go hunt the ice wraith. I thought that was really cool.
That's a nice
with the Empire, you kind of just, like, sign the form and and get going.
I think too, and this is something that, you know, they say that Nords in their culture have been quite superstitious, and they have bad omens and things like that. You can imagine, like, you know, I think it is Canis root to stop the werebears coming, or it's like, oh, anything bad happens, it's the Falmer, the snow elves that come and take your children away, or like all wrongdoing. So they have all of this sort of superstition. That's actually something I feel like we didn't see a whole lot of. A lot of critiques of Skyrim is that a lot of the Nords act, it's just kind of like, you know, Hollywood Vikings, but they're just kind of like us, if that makes sense. Like, but it's like, where are all the characters who are doing these things and, like, are really superstitious about X, Y, and Z? And do you know what I mean? Like,
you kind of got that vibe with, I mean, it's an entirely different culture, but you got a feeling of that vibe with the Skarl. Like, it would have been cool to have that energy more on Skyrim with certain people, even if they obviously don't worship the Allmaker, but just that vibe being present in Skyrim a lot more, like that tribal, like you said, superstition. It is cool. I mean, you do actually see evidence of Falmer doing stuff. There's bits and pieces where you kind of, like, and that's like all cool superstitions. There's a nugget of truth to them. If they're just a superstition, like, you know, oh, this spirit comes in the night, but you never see it, it's like, okay. But if you actually see, like, a dead guy on the road and he's got Falmer arrows in his back, but there's no Falmer in sight, then it's cool, because it's like,
I don't want to turn this too much into, like, a rant or a sort of hot take video.
But here we go.
But here we go.
But I'm going to do it anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. No. But, like, one thing that frustrates me a little bit when people, so like people might hear these critiques and be like, well, it's not realistic, they can't put it in the game or so on. It's like, oh, of course, they're just stories, it's not going to be, it's all going to be exaggeration and like, you know, and hyperbole, etc. It's, but it's sort of like, but it's a fantasy world. Like, it's like, why not have it in the fantasy world that, that talks about it? Like, let's have the mythology, you know, the actual, you know, cool stuff actually be there rather it being watered down, because then it's like, oh, realism within it, because it's like, oh, of course he didn't actually do X, Y, Z.
But is that actually a common take?
Huh?
Is that actually a common take that people have, that like that stuff's not there because it's not?
Well, imagine having that attitude towards Morrowind.
Yeah, because
Morrowind seems to embody all of those. But then again, you know, it was a long time ago. It was 2002. Yeah. So, but yeah, all of the things you think, oh, surely that wouldn't work out too
well. I've seen it around. I think it's more so in responses. It's just like the default assumption for all, a lot of mythological texts, you know, I know 36 Lessons of Vec has other like shade on it. But, you know, plenty of these mythical sort of things described in the books and the lore, I said like, of course, that's not the real way it went down, because, you know, it has to be like our real world where people's ancient ideas of myths or the world was, you know, the reason Mount Olympus, all this kind of whatever stuff, like any other mythology, we go like, oh yeah, it's not real because, you know, science, X, Y, Z, practical, like we can't replicate it, see it. But applying that kind of thing to the lore, like, because they basically cast an equal amount of doubt, but it's like, we're in this world though, where all of this.
Sorry, you're just making me think of this comment. I don't want to call out the guy, but I mean, I'm not going to, I don't even know who the commenter is. But you remember the comment that was on the Temple of Scrib video, and it was like, I've got a simple explanation for why there's a different banner, economics, and then goes on this whole rant about how the Dwemer were using contractors who they would like basically have on their payroll to like make their banners for them. And then the contractor ran out of ink and got a different ink. And like the comment was so confident though. He was so sure about this like real world economic viewpoint. I'm like, dude.
But that's what I'm sort of saying. It's like reducing things to this, like to, you know, the simplest kind of causes or so on. And like, you know, debunking superstition and all that kind of stuff is something that's very practical in our real world or so on. But in a world where there is quite literally gods and magic and all this kind of stuff, it doesn't make sense that you would cast the same amount of shade on these mythological kind of happenings in books and so on. You know what I mean?
It's the same. Absolutely.
Plus, a big part of the fun is taking things that were quite clearly just developer mistakes or things that were just done by the devs completely without any thought, and taking that and forging theories from it. And then some of them, I wouldn't be able to name one off the top of my head, but then some of them kind of becoming accepted canon and being used in future games. It's like, part of the fun of this stuff and why we still do it, you know, why we still love it after all these years, is because there's just so many ways you can interpret all of this lore, and to just give it the to give everything the most basic explanation would be boring.
I agree. But it's like the explanations people give sometimes when they try and like work their way around things that there is no answer for, they're not even simple. They're actually complex, but they're based in real world things. You're like, oh yeah, that sounds right. But it's like, really? Like Dwemer's having like banner makers on a payroll.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. Like, well, it's like when they're,
like,
that's
they
the
wouldn't
thing,
do
like,
it themselves. Like, not everything's this capitalist, like,
exactly. They're applying
lens.
Like the I think that's what sucks. Even a lot of fantasy stuff can do it, is they apply real world sensibilities, real world economics, and like, sorry, what I mean real world, I mean like modern our contemporary stuff, all to it. Like, you know, that's why actually a lot appeals to me or so on about like cultures like the Reachmen or even the Dunmer, or these cultures that have these kind of like,
even orcs.
Yeah, orcs, they have these, what by contemporary modern standards, they're distasteful, you know, attitudes, but they're really interesting because they're alien and different and unique, and they come from such a, they come from a different context and a different time. Like how, if you go back in time in our own history, really early humans do some really whack shit and they think it's real. Like, they're not going, oh, I'm doing this funny stuff. It's like, no, they think if I eat these horses' nuts, I'm going to get superpowers or something like that. And then everyone around them also believes that. Yeah. And then you know.
Look, placebo. Scott, placebo's eating, strong.
Eating horse nuts is not going to catch on. Stop trying to make it happen.
Yeah.
But to tie it back to Nord superstitions, it is funny how, you know, the idea that they blame everything on the Falmer, and there is the idea that they're pulling, you know, sneaky stuff behind the scenes. But I mean, contextually, it must be really weird if you live in a place where these like gremlin golem creatures hiding about, and they you know, they're semi-intelligent, and the reason they're so miserable and everything about their existence is awful is because your race absolutely destroyed them completely. And it's like, well, maybe they do have a grudge against you. It probably isn't that far-fetched. If they can remember, then
yeah,
they probably want to get their revenge.
Who started it, I guess? It all depends on if they... they started it, I guess, but the Eye of Magnus, like, was that under Sarthal? Were they trying to get that? Were they just... Did they just fear the Nords culture was
two
surpassing theirs?
Two wrongs don't make a right, Michael.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
No, but I wonder...
What about three wrongs?
How many people died at Sarthal? Is there a number on that?
I can't remember, but it kind of been, like, crazy big. It was described as a settlement, but then it's also a decent-looking city, but then they also had some clearly powerful kind of architecture. By the way, which is another thing we can talk about their culture, but obviously a lot of their architecture is also made of... wood, but they're quite the good architects in the way that, like, Isgrimor's palace, stands for a long, long time. Although I'm pretty sure that might have been knocked and rebuilt, I'm not sure. But a lot of their wooden structures are really resilient and almost otherworldly. Like, look at Dragon's Reach, it's been around for ages, and it's a lot of wood used in its construction. Or you can look at the boats, like, you know, Jorvaska, the home of the companions. You know, you could, this is the thing where it's like, that's supposedly the boat, the Jorvaska, that came over with the 500 companions, flipped upside down and turned into a longhouse. People can cast shade on that, because, nah, that's just a lie, and so on. It's like, but in this world, they literally came and with 500 companions just wide genocided an entire race. Like, is it really so unbelievable that their boat's really strong or durable?
One thing as well is normally you'd make the argument that, you know, in how we see Whiterun in Skyrim, Jorvaska would have rotted thousands of years ago, but even in a real world context, if the climate's cold enough, and if Skyrim is like it used to be described, then a wooden structure can last, you know, theoretically it can last forever. You know, there's no reason it would rot if it's cold enough. True. You know, obviously the way Whiterun is a very sunny and nice place a lot of the year, so you'd think it would rot, but as you said, it's kind of like, well, with all the stuff going on, we're not going to talk about at what speed wood rots at what temperature.
Well, one thing we haven't covered, actually, and it's probably the place we really should talk about, but it is the Nordic pantheon. Like, we don't need to talk about the Imperial one that they worship today. We know that. But does anyone else want to talk?
I guess one of the coolest things about their pantheon is that the head of their deities isn't a version of Akatosh or Auriel. Mm. It's actually Lorcan, who they call Shaw.
Yeah.
Which I think is super cool. And the other thing is they give all of their, the members of their pantheon kind of like familial relations. So you have Kain, who Shaw is the husband of Kain. Kain is Shaw's wife.
And I guess another important part of that dynamic, just real quick, is that Shaw is known in their mythology as the dead chieftain of the gods. He died in their mythology before, and that's why he's in Sovngarde and he's gathering souls in his hall. And Kain is known as the widow, and that's of Shaw. And Kain actually becomes like she is basically the head of their pantheon, because Shaw's, you know, god of the underworld is gone. Like, the current one that they would, you know, pray to or they want for power or something is Kain, and that's why her importance with the breath and storm and yada yada.
And she carries them to Sovngarde when they die.
Oh, and she quite literally created them in their mythology as well.
Exactly, like a mother, and like Shaw almost like a father. And then Sun is an interesting god because I believe there's no there's no contemporary version of Sun, or like, you can't draw it to anything
direct,
like,
equivalent. Yeah,
like Junal being Julianos and Kain being Kinnereth. Like, Sun is just Sun.
Yeah. Oh, and
Shield Thane of Shaw, and also a dead god.
Well, that's the thing too. What's cool is that a lot of the, and that's why he guards the Whalebone Bridge, because he's also dead. But you have a lot of these gods are sort of evolutions of the old totemic religion. So, you know, you have Shaw being the fox, Kain being the eagle, got Mara as the wolf,
Sun's the bear,
Debella being the moth, which ones? Junal is the owl, and Stun is the whale, I'm pretty sure, and Orky's the snake. I was going to say, oh, that's another interesting thing just to throw out there. As you know about the Imperialized Divines, most of them are a mixture of previous things. So, you know, there's Kyne, Kinnereth, both have Mara, etc. But Debella is a human god, seemingly, or an Atmoran god. It seems to have come down with the Nords, which is just an interesting sort of... It's funny, but like... I know when you think Nords, you think like, oh, big burly barbarians and so on, but a lot of their gods, their most important gods, are female as well, like, and play a really important part.
Like Debella being like artistic and stuff like this. Yeah.
And Mara is also known as the handmaiden of Kyne and concubine of Shor, which is another interesting. And that's the kind of thing where it's example, like those gods kind of imply that perhaps there is like a polyamory sort of situation for like powerful chieftains have multiple, like have a wife and like concubines and so on. It's something you never really see in they just kind of like act, the Jarls act exactly like the Counts of Oblivion. So they're very imperial in their sort of outside of just some trappings.
It is cool though to see how the different gods have much different meanings, to be honest, in the Nordic pantheon compared with the Divine's pantheon. Like even Stendar, who in their religion is Stun, who's actually the brother of Tsun. Like that's really cool. It actually makes me think, who is Stendar's brother in other like religions? But anyway. He was the god of ransom, like Stendar, god of ransom, who taught the Nords the benefit of taking prisoners of war and how to do it. Like, that's much more hardcore than, like...
How it develops, though, right? Because it's like the idea of taking prisoners, and then you've got Stendar, who's about, like, merciful forbearance. Mm. And, you know, taking a prisoner rather than just executing all your enemies is, in a way, a form of mercy.
Yeah, you know, it's the Nordic mercy, their version of things, you know.
That's as merciful as they get.
And if anything, as we talked about how, like, Shor Lorkhan is the head of their pantheon, Alduin is how they understood Akatosh, and he is the antagonist of their entire pantheon. He's the world eater. He's going to come and bring essentially their equivalent of Ragnarok. That is what the plays on. But obviously we get a little bit of a different kind of view when we get to the sort of dragon cult stuff, and you get like Akatosh quite literally being like, I'm here to dominate the world and so on, and that
Alduin.
I kind of like his old interpretation of just the harbinger of the end, but less like a, you know, I'm king of the dragons and I'm going to dominate you all. But you know, maybe it's just me. And then we also have Orki, which is a complicated one. Like the most typical idea is you could go like
it's Malakath, kind of.
Yeah, like because
and RK to an extent.
Because if you think about what they're missing RK and they're missing Xenathar. And I think that's the only reason I've seen Sun compared to Xenathar, but
it's It's
a stretch. It's just like, oh, it's the missing god, so let's just
give it Xenathar. Stun.
Sun.
Stun, Stendar, and then
gotcha.
But there's Xenathar. I've seen that, but I think it's a bit of a weak comparison outside of that. Oh, well, what's the equivalent
we're missing
of
one.
That?
Yeah.
Pretty much. And but then Orki would fulfill like the sort of RK kind of part.
I mean, it's like a weird mix. And I guess that Orki was involved in that battle with the Nords where he like didn't he make them 8 children?
Yeah, well, he brought back the ghost of Alduin, who then ate the children down, ate the Nords down to children.
And they were like 6-year-olds, and then...
Yeah.
Which is what gave them shortened lifespans until Shor chucked it back on the orcs, right? And chucked it on the nearby orcs, and that's why orcs have human lifespans.
Yeah, instead of elven, yeah, exactly.
And to them, he's known as the god of mortality, as well. By the way, what's interesting is I know before like he is the lone god for the Nord, or he is a lone god for the Nords. Does that mean like lone, like, you know how people have a, you know, like Romans had a lone god, like they would loan, like gods would be loaned from the Egyptians or so on, they would adopt new gods. Is that what it's saying, or is it
perhaps
literally Because that would you could interpret it two ways. You could be like, oh, he's a god of like loans and debts and stuff like that. Or you could be it's like a god that has been adopted from another culture.
Yeah, I'm just.
I would say it's he's been adopted. That's how I would interpret that.
Yeah,
I mean, adopted. I can't see any connection.
Yeah,
to...
oh, sorry, it makes sense. Who seemed to have taken up his worship during Aldmeri rule of Atmora?
Yeah,
so it seems like it's actually an Aldmeri god that has been introduced to them, which also explains why you know RK is part of their pantheon. I think that only, to be honest, I wonder how much Orki is connected to the orcs.
Hmm. Well, I mean, he's still an enemy. He's still an enemy god for the Nords, and the Nords oppose. Orcs and they oppose elves, so
yeah, because I'm pretty sure Morlock, as in Malekith, is identified separately in their mythology too, in the Wulfar story from Orki too.
It is.
So I wonder why it combines aspects of both. Maybe it's just the throwing the age onto the nearby orcs part. Complex stuff, eh?
Yeah, it is. There's also other gods that, like Jinal. Who is meant to be Julianos, and Jinal is involved with like Nordic language and mathematics and
I love
runes
the god of,
and language and stuff like that.
I love the god of knowledge, him being god of knowledge and hermetic orders, which sort of implies like the more like philosophical kind of like, you know, actual like hermeticism. So it's like it's interesting that it makes the ancient clever men, because it's usually like Jinal fell out of favor, but you know, mages used to be respected by ancient Nords and the clever man, but it makes it seem a little bit more like philosophical and like, you know, enlightened state kind of magic related rather than just like academia. Yeah. Expelliarmus.
And falling out of favor wasn't that long ago either, right? It was the clever men falling out of favor. That was in response to the great collapse, right?
That was just mages in general. I think mages still were still not liked even before then for a while. Clever men are like an ancient thing. I'm not exactly sure when the shift would have happened, but obviously they were important, I guess, even around the times of the dragon cult. To be honest, maybe in the dragon cult could have smeared them a little bit, you know what I mean? Like you know, because you have essentially what a powerful like mages, like each of the dragon priests and so on, and they could have had a negative association.
It was very much magic that helped them overcome that.
But the Thorm, I guess they would distinguish it differently.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess.
Like one of them, they find like an innate, like sort of meditative power that, you know what I mean? That's given to them from a kind versus like this witchcraft. And I wish they played up that superstitious stuff more than it's something like in Elder Scrolls 6, if it is in Hammerfell. Like I want to see those superstitious like red guards and stuff that are really like anti-magic. I don't want to just see like... I don't want to just see the College of Winterhold attitude towards magic just all, you know, transplanted into Hammerfell, because it's just such a weak source. Like, oh, we don't like them, but we tolerate them anyway. Like, it's like, no, let's have some conflict there. It's juicy. Let's make some, you know, fun war.
Yeah. I mean, you can imagine in Hammerfell seeing some really cool stuff with being super anti-undead. Like, I would want to see the Ashabar and how... like they despise they are, despite them being killers of undead. Like people are said to not like them simply because they are involved with the undead in any way.
Yeah.
Even though they're killing them.
You know what? You know what? Thanks to all this ESO lore too, like they might take it all into account and they might actually make a really sick Elder Scrolls 6. So
just with but they'll have Elder Scrolls Online like motifs and armor design, so it just looks a little bit extra World of Warcraft for you.
I wish they would kind of go back to about Oblivion ish maybe even more than, like, I just, you know what I mean, like I just want realistic sized non-paddle sword, non sort of like giant Warcrafty looking things. I don't know, I always play with like really better shaped weapons or realistic sort of shaped weapon mods.
Here
and stuff
he is at the start of the video saying, "Let fantasy be fantasy." Now he's saying, "Why aren't my weapons real enough?"
That's just an aesthetic preference, and ultimately, you can do both. Like, I think it's the best when you have.
Yeah,
like,
I agree. You can have a Daedric.
Because otherwise, it's like
a Daedric artifact
that looks thin. like, yeah, a Daedric artifact as well.
Yeah, well, yeah, but like you could have your regular kind of smithed weapons be more realistic and more practical, and then your strange gift from a Daedric prince that can just kind of defy your normal rules of physics that stands out a lot more rather than just being a skin over the top of a normal looking sword or something. Yeah. So you can have both, yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise you can also just like follow that all the way up to the sort of like, let's have Final Fantasy and World of Warcraft sort of designs, like big giant swords the size of your head, and it's just kind of like...
But I mean, we don't need to use our imagination for this. There are mods for Skyrim now, like we use them, that actually, is it better shaped weapons? They just slim down the weapons a bit, but they still look super fantasy because, you know, it's a glass war axe and it's all curvy with elven
Oblivion
looking designs.
For the
it's just tighter.
Yeah, Oblivion for the most part. All like the designs and so on all looked
Oblivion
sweet,
had
like the
some fat designs.
It did have some fat ones, but a lot of their weapons were better shaped and stuff like that. But this is all not Nord related. But you guys in the comments also say that you like when we go on tangents and stuff, so we've held back a little bit less recently.
I've been that whole time I was trying to kind of theory craft on the fly because we were trying to figure out what it is about Orki that's just something not quite right. And one unusual thing I had seen was that before there was clarification that Shaw was very much associated with a fox, a lot of people used to think that, or by a lot of people I mean a couple of forum posts I read ages ago, that that Shaw was the snake, because in a lot of cultures, Lorcan is considered to be a snake. You know, like I think...
the trickster god.
Yeah. Yeah, so you got the Redguard pantheon, the Argonian pantheon. I think he's a snake in both of those, because you got Tulpapa crushing him with a stick, and I can't remember what he's called in the Argonian one. But basically, he's a sneaky snake, and there's definitely elements of Orki that you can almost see it as being the duality of Lorcan / Shaw fighting against himself. But at the same time, I'm pulling this out of my ass, so we can. You know, he might just be Arcane Malakath.
Yeah. But to be honest, he's actually like... He's one thing. He's... If I could like retcon / fix Orki, I would. Because I don't know if he's like perfectly like... He's not like well executed, if you know what I mean. Like he kind of just muddles stuff up and it's like, ooh, mystery. But it's like not in a good way. Kind of like just confusing, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys agree or not, but
I kind of agree when you try and dive into it, but when you just hear the stories, they sound pretty cool.
Yeah, but
like,
what
I
I'm
like
saying is
you could keep the
stories and fix the god. Like,
yeah, for sure.
Is what I'm saying. Like everything confusing about him isn't the good bits. It's just the sort of shade thrown over him. But I think the problem with discussing Norns is it's like I feel like we can kind of say a lot of things to you guys, and it's just like, they have Jarls, and then it's like, you know, you've played Skyrim, like you've kind of experienced it.
I guess
firsthand.
The only thing you could touch on, obviously, is they worship like Ismir and like I guess their love for Talos. I suppose you'd put with divines.
Yeah, like yeah. I mean, you can kind of have, you know, the whole worship of Talos anyway. I guess if you want to get into the complicated stuff, where you have like Wulfarth is a component of Talos, so the old Ismir that they would, you know, revere so much is the new Ismir to them is Talos. And but you know, whatever. It's I mean, Nords are definitely one of those. It's funny because sometimes they're seen, they can feel rather plain, but then there's some really cool stuff in there. But they can't you can't have the Elder Scrolls without them, because they are like the most one of the most central.
I think that's such a cool video you should write. What if the Nords didn't exist, or didn't come to it?
What if I guess you go like, what if Isgrimmor never came? Like, what if they just stayed in Atmore, and so they're basically the Nords never come afterwards? And because it would be an interesting thing, because you'd only have needs, and I guess, you know, you would still work that theoretical on with the, let's just say, the inevitability of Yakuta sinking and the Red Guards coming still. So it would just be a different world.
I wonder if, so many different things would have needed to happen, because I was going to say, without the Nords, perhaps the needs in Cyrodiil could still have eventually overcome the Aelids, but maybe with the help of the Bretons, but at the same time, really, the way was par for the Bretons to rule High Rock, because the Dareni had to deal with so many different problems, one of which being the Elysian Order. So, you know, without, like, the Elysians, are there Bretons?
I feel like with all, like, you know, with the Mora House and the Pact with Akatosh and Pelennor Whitestrake, I feel like it's feasible you could still have the Elysian Rebellion be successful, but you could do to it, like, a differing degree, and then maybe, or maybe instead, the war isn't some, like, you know, over in a year or two or whatever it was. Instead, it's like a prolonged thing.
Maybe, you know, Pelennor just wipes out the entire elven population of Tamriel and becomes the god king of Tamriel. And that's the end of the story. Yeah, because he probably could have done it single-handedly.
See, there's interesting things, but would Pelennor have been there without the Nords? And this is an interesting thing, because there's... Did he come over with them, perhaps, even? Because you know how there's this whole thing with Pelennor Whitestrake being other characters, like Hans the Fox and Harald Hairy Breeks or whatever it was, and, like, he's got different, you know, identities as previous kings, and he would just make kingdoms and then leave and so on. But, like, was this all happening as him being, like, do you know what I mean? Like, is his essence, or him, and especially since he's connected to, like, you know, as, like, a Shezarine, or, like, related to Shor / Lorcan, which is a very, like, Atmoran thing. Like, maybe he did come over with... Not at first. Like, he could have been the Harald Hairy Breeks, and which, by the way, I just want to find that out. Hold on.
Well, while you're doing that, yeah. I think Shor's influence would have been there no matter what, because I feel like he backs humans at the end of the day. He will back humans because, you know, I've talked about this a lot before, but there's a huge emphasis on Akatosh being the one to kind of uplift the Elysians and help them, take over the Aelids. But really, most of it can be more closely associated with Shor and his role, and, you know, and obviously when Lorcan's heart is being shot across the world, a drop of his blood falls into an Aelid well, and that's where the red diamond is born. So there's a lot of build up to it still there, even without the Nords.
The one reason I bring that up, and him being a thing that sort of came over with the Atmorans, is so two of his it is claimed he had other names as an immortal sorcerer king, such as Ismir, which is a very Nordic Atmorany sounding thing. Harald Hairy Breeks, which is very clearly a nod to, you know, the stories at Ragnar. Yeah. Lothbrok meaning, like, shaggy breeches or so on, basically like hairy pants or whatever. And then also Hans the Fox. But, like, these are all sort of, you know, like, they would sound like names of Nords and stuff that you meet and so on. And, you know, between when he shows up as Pelennor Whitestrake and when Isgrimor first arrived, it's like minimum 700 years, you know, so it could have even been more. And that's plenty of time for him to come over, raise kingdoms and fall and so on. And
well, it's funny because Shor is the fox too, like Hans the Fox. It's
yeah, exactly.
It's cool.
Yeah. But, like, that's what makes me think is like, well, if Isgrimor never came and sort of that, you know, energy never showed up.
I'll say this, if Shazar was always looking out to have the backs of men, he took his time, didn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, like, if they were just being, like, dominated by the Aelids for so long.
Because it's even things, because, yeah. I was going to say, like, even the Reachmen and so on, I wonder how they're, if they would even... I guess they call him Lork. But yeah, the dominant, also, you would never have Shazar.
No.
Because Shazar was just a compromise, so
at least you would have just swept him under the rug completely if it wasn't for Nordic pressure, I think.
Yeah, but like Shor never really comes into there. They never really know who he is.
Yeah,
right.
Mm.
Because then they're just worshipping the elven gods like they worship. So then it's just men for they're worshipping elven gods, and it'd be interesting. You'd never have Akatosh because unless they got strong, you could still maybe, but.
Yeah, like, I mean, you could have the gods essentially giving visions to someone like Alicia anyway, you know, like whoever answers her call and provides Pelennor and Mora House, they can just pass on the message.
But if you make the argument, if there is no Pelennor, like no Pelennor figure there, and if it is just a Mora House job, I don't know of how far it's going to get.
It just becomes a big province of Minotaurs and...
Yeah.
It's forever changed.
Look, I think it's fairly safe to say, even though there's a lot of variables here, that without the Nords, you wouldn't have had the big change in tone from Tamriel being very much elven controlled to being human controlled. That shift would never have happened were it not for Isgrimor bringing his companions.
yeah.
to Skyrim.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right.
Nice.
I think, unless you guys got anything extra to add, we already talked about the dragon cult a fair bit in the Dragons podcast, so hence why we didn't dwell on that part too much. But yeah. I feel like we can come back with some more focused conversations on certain
elements. Well, tell us in the comments below what topics you would want to see us cover on a future podcast, obviously not the next one, that involve the Nords. So specific topics, maybe you want a podcast all about the voice and all the philosophy involved with that. So you let us know in the comments below. Social media links are there too. And we look forward to nerding out with you again very soon.